Veterans Radio is dedicated to the men and women who have served and who are serving now as protectors of this great nation.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Good morning, America. Bob Gould right here on Veterans Radio, coming to you from the Garden Spot of the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and broadcasting on WDEO as part of the Ave Maria Network. And welcome all those who are also listening to us on the Internet. Be sure and tell your friends they can listen to us no matter where. If they can't pick up the terrestrial signal, then go to veteransradio.net. Of course, they got all that www.business. So here we are in the studios. Oh, what a program we have today. I mean, you got to go back a little bit, right? Horse soldiers. Who would have ever known? Horse soldiers. Yes, in Afghanistan back in 2001, the Americans really didn't have a vehicle to go in the deserts, to go through the terrain in Afghanistan. And what did they do? They did what the Afghans did. They got some horses. That's right. A cavalry. And that's what they did. Oh, you're going to want to stick around and catch this program. It was pre-recorded on July 2nd, 2010. So it is pre-recorded, but we felt it was a real special program. And from time to time, we will be presenting other programs as part of our salute and the best of. Yeah, but just before we get to that, here's a couple of little things. You know, Veterans Day is coming, November 10th. You're going to want to check with a number of restaurants. There is a website. Just Google Veterans Day restaurants open, and you'll be able to find. There's quite a few. One of them happens to be Applebee's. That's right. They're going to be having meals available at discounts as well. I believe it's going to be covered at 100%. That's right, to be a veteran. Now, you're going to have to bring some ID, so bring your ID card along and take advantage of that Veterans Day. There's also going to be a ton of memorial services and events available, so you're going to want to go on the Internet and Google Veterans Day 2011. Here's one. It just so happens to be local. But again, we'd like to present all these events that are taking place. So check those of you that are out in Washington. Those of you that are out in, where is it at? New Jersey. That's where Dale's headed for right now. The shores of New Jersey. I wonder if they're getting any saltwater taffy. Well, while you're eating your saltwater taffy, you're going to want to go to some of these events. Right, Veterans Day. Well, last week we did a program on jobs, jobs, jobs. So here's some more things that are as a result of the big national effort for the VA and Veterans Administration to tell you about jobs. They are available, so they're out there. You're going to want your resume. You're going to want to get a pen and paper handy. If you don't have a job and you're looking at this, that's great. If you don't have a job and you don't do it, no, that's not cool. So go out and check this out. Here's something. Employers, the Veterans Job Fair, National Guard Drill Hall, November 10th, 2011, in Lansing, Michigan. Oh, I know, that's that other city. I shouldn't even say that. But anyway, employers seeking to recruit are returning and recently separated hometown heroes who can help our country to reduce turnover costs and enhance your corporate image. Here is your opportunity. This unique pool of honorable, experienced, and highly skilled veterans display their talents during this event. There is no veteran or employer registration costs associated with this event. Remember, your best bet is to hire a vet. So that's a Veterans Job Fair, National Guard Drill Hall, November 10th, 2011, 10 o'clock till 3 o'clock. So what do? Okay, you go to, once again, Google Veterans Job Fairs. This one happens to be in Lansing on November 10th. Here's an email, if you got your pencil and paper handy. West, W-E-S-T-M, like in motel, at Michigan.gov. Let me give you that again. West, W-E-S-T-M, at Michigan.gov. This is hosted by the Michigan Army National Guard, the Michigan Air National Guard, and State of Michigan Workforce Development Agency, Veterans Service Division. I think you're going to find that when you hire a vet, you know, these guys coming back from the Middle East, they got discipline. Besides the training, they learn to take orders. They know how to get it done. So your best bet is to hire a vet. Okay, well, coming right along now, before we get to our first guest, which is Doug Stanton, Horse Soldiers. I bet you can't wait for that. Horse Soldiers. Imagine that in Afghanistan. Anyway, on the line with me right now is Rebecca Hyduck Rundell. Rebecca Hyduck Rundell, an MSW with the Veterans Administration. She is the Caregiver Support Coordinator. Now, who would know about that? It's all brand new, and she's going to tell us all about that. Rebecca, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Bob. Thank you for inviting me on the radio today.
Well, it's our pleasure, as well as getting the information out to our listeners. Caregivers. Veterans are getting older. There are still World War II guys, Korean War, Vietnam vet, as well as Middle Eastern veterans. Caregivers of veterans of all eras. And I understand November is Caregiver Month. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
November is Caregiver Month, and the VA, as well as many outside agencies, are putting on activities to provide information and education and support to caregivers. The VA has, our theme for Caregiver Month is identifying caregivers. So we're working right now to reach out to caregivers of all veterans to help provide them with support, enroll them in the caregiver program, and identify their needs and concerns. One of our biggest goals is to help veterans stay in their home. And in order to do that, they need a caregiver. A lot of them need a caregiver, and it's a difficult job.
Yes.
So we're wanting to support these caregivers to help the veterans stay at home. Some activities that we are doing at the Ann Arbor VA are on November 17th. We have a resource fair at the hospital. This resource fair is going to include a lot of different departments at the VA hospital, as well as outside agencies such as Alzheimer's Association, Social Security, a wide variety of nursing homes, adult daycare facilities. So we're looking at as many different resources we can find to help provide support to our caregivers.
Now, a lot of the caregiver support or caregivers are usually a spouse or another relative. Is that correct?
Yes, they are. They're usually a spouse or another relative. Sometimes they're friends. We see a lot of different varieties of caregivers, people that really step up to try and help support these veterans.
And that is a job in itself.
Yes, it is.
And it does. It does. It gives you stress. I took care of my mom and my dad, and I know about that. As much as you love them, you still got to do the work. You got to be there. So when we talk about having a caregiver, you need to have someone that is trained, correct?
Yes.
Because there is something called ADLs, assisted daily living. Why don't you tell us about that? And how does that go back to the veteran and the caregiver support program?
Okay. We do look at activities of daily living. We have 7 activities of daily living that we have identified. These are things such as dressing and undressing, personal hygiene, meaning bathing, grooming, toileting, being able to feed oneself, transferring, from a bed to a chair or from the toilet to a shower, and any adjustment of any special prosthetic. So what we do is we look at each individual veteran and their needs, and the veterans that are seen at the Ann Arbor VA have a treatment team, and they will assist in training the caregivers to be able to provide these services, especially if they are in need of some specialty care. We also have a telephone support group for caregivers of veterans with dementia, and on those calls we spend a significant amount of time talking about different behaviors and different ways that these caregivers can continue to help the veterans.
Now caregivers, mm-hmm. you mentioned the seven ADLs because those are the triggers, correct?
Yes.
So, like in long-term care insurance, at least a minimum of two ADLs must be present before that's a covered benefit. What
correct.
About with veterans?
With veterans, it depends on the program. So most programs, like you said, have two ADLs. We are really looking at one ADL for the caregiver to be enrolled in the family caregiver program. And in addition to ADLs, we also look at the veteran's need to have some protection or supervision based on a neurological impairment, such as a traumatic brain injury, psychological trauma, or other mental disorder. Oftentimes, veterans can complete their ADLs, such as bathing, grooming, but they're not able to organize their day. They're not able to manage their medications. They're not able to pay their bills, and they really need that type of support to stay safely in the home. So we also look at that as a caregiver role that needs some support and training.
I was in the insurance business prior lifetime, and this is fantastic. Caregivers that are eligible for this program and vets, the caregivers do not give custodial care. So folks, washing dishes, washing the floor, no. We're talking about those ADLs, assisted daily living, and the caregivers are giving that right now, and the veteran is not able to perform them. Now, who gives that evaluation?
That is an evaluation that's done by myself or by the treatment team that the veteran is enrolled with. So that could be a primary care doctor, a social worker, psychiatrist, nurse practitioner, physical therapist, occupational therapist. So anyone that works with the caregiver or the veteran at the VA hospital, they're able to do these evaluations, and then they'll notify me if they have concerns about caregivers needing support or training. They'll notify me, and then I will look towards connecting them with the appropriate resources.
Now, folks, keep in mind, this is available throughout all the VAs, right?
Yes, it is available throughout all the VAs. It's a nationwide program, and there are three ways to be able to access information on this program. We have a website, and that is www.caregiver.va.gov. We also have a VA caregiver support line, and that number is 1-855-260-3274. Now, the support line is staffed by licensed clinical social workers, so you're not calling and just getting someone who just answers the phone and isn't able to provide support. These are licensed clinical social workers. We do have designated hours, Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. until 11 p.m., and Saturdays from 10:30 a.m. until 6 p.m. However, any time that you call this line, it will be answered. If you call outside of those designated hours, you will be connected to the Veterans Crisis Line, and then they will then refer the caregiver back to the licensed clinical social worker that's overseeing the support line.
Now, this program is all brand new. The current administration put this program in place, where, in May of this year?
Yes. Well, May 2010, the current administration signed into law Public Law 111-163, which is Caregivers and Veterans Omnibus Health Services Act of 2010. So since that time, the VA has been working very hard to develop the best kind of program and the best kind of services for the veterans. In February of 2011, we started the support line. Now, one aspect of the caregiver program is for post-9/11 veterans who were seriously injured in the line of duty and require a caregiver to stay in the home.
Does that include PTSD?
That does include PTSD. It includes any physical impairments, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury. And what we do for this program is on May 9th, 2011, we started accepting applications to the Comprehensive Family Program for this population of veterans.
How has your response been?
My response has been very well. We have 11 approved veterans at the Ann Arbor VA. I just looked at my my Vizen area, which is part of what the Ann Arbor VA is connected to, and we have close to 200 veterans enrolled in this part of the program, and I believe we're in the thousands nationwide.
Folks, think about this. Long-term care insurance was to cover caregivers after you have two ADLs, but this program is being brought to you by your Veterans Administration. This is your tax dollars at work. We'd like to hear where that is, and this is your tax dollars at work. And they are. They're helping you veterans out there or families of veterans, those that are not a veteran, as a listener, of course, maybe you have a family person or a friend, relatives. Wow. And you have access to these support groups. Somebody is taking care of you. That's huge, huge. And it's going through... Well, what did you call it the other? I mean, all these acronyms, right? This is the the VA health system? Is that what you told me on the phone?
Yes. Yes, I'm part of the health system, so I work through the hospital, and the caregiver support program is through the health system. So we work through the hospitals, and we work with our central office and a wide variety of administration programs to ensure that these benefits are getting out there to caregivers of veterans, because without these caregivers, we couldn't do this.
Absolutely. And by the way, if you all went and got a pencil or pen while she was giving that email or that website, once again, it's www.caregiver, that's www.caregiver.va.gov. www.caregiver.va.gov. I know that this could be very taxing on the relative who is a caregiver, spouse, etc., and you're giving that relief. Wow. I mean, hello. We're going to have you on again, Rebecca, from time to time to remind our listeners out there that this is available. And if you're looking at the ADLs, one more time, what was the mental attributes that you were looking for?
Well, we're looking for, in addition to activities of daily living, supervision or protection or assistance based on symptoms of residuals of neurological or other impairments or injury, including traumatic brain injury, psychological trauma, or other mental disorders, and also including post-traumatic stress disorder. Some of the things that we evaluate for those impairments or injuries are, is the veteran suffering from seizures? Do they have difficulty with planning and organizing? Do they have difficulty with managing their medications? Is there a safety risk involved? Do they have moments where they are experiencing some PTSD symptoms and they're not able to recognize where they are or what they should be doing? Are they having difficulty with sleeping? Delusions or hallucinations, difficulty with recent memory, or being able to regulate their moods.
And how many quote unquote caregivers out there are not experienced? What do I do? Who is going to help me? I think this is fantastic. Good. Once again, to see our government working for the vet. Now, one more time, you call your local VA hospital, okay?
Yes.
Request to speak to the caregiver support coordinator.
Yes.
Each hospital has a caregiver support coordinator. Now, before that, there was something called aid and attendance. What's the difference?
Aid and attendance is a benefit that's through the benefits department. This is not something that's involved with the caregiver support program. The benefit is out there. We are aware of it. If someone were to call me and ask me about aid and attendance, I would get them connected with somebody who was an expert in that area, so a service officer or someone that works for the regional benefits office. The difference, too, with this aid and attendance and the caregiver program that we have available to post 9/11 veterans is that one does not affect the other financially. And I wanted to touch quickly on the program for the post 9/11 veterans that were seriously injured in the line of duty. There is an application process that they need to go through, because one of the comprehensive and advanced benefits that they have is this caregiver can receive a financial stipend, they can receive insurance, and they can receive some mental health counseling.
Wow. Wow, wow, I know my jaw dropped when we talked the other day to find out about this program. That's fantastic. And it's not going away. You're funded, correct?
Correct.
Well, November is Caregiver Month, so you're going to want to call your local VA if you have any questions or know of anyone you need support. That's a caregiver support program, and you want to speak at your local VA at the local hospital for the caregiver support coordinator. Before we get off the air, Rebecca, is there anything that you'd like to add?
I really appreciate this opportunity to get this information out there to caregivers. Like I said, it's very important to us that the veterans are able to be comfortable in their homes, and oftentimes without a caregiver, this isn't possible. So we really want to thank all those caregivers out there and very much appreciate each and every one of you. And I'm looking forward to November as Caregiver Month, being able to identify these caregivers. So, you know, I just cannot emphasize enough, if you are caring for a veteran, please contact your local VA hospital and let us help you help them.
Thank you, Rebecca, for being on Veterans Radio.
Anytime. I really appreciate this opportunity.
We will have you on again.
Great, thank
you.
Because
it's such an important, important program. Remember, it's coming from your government, and this is your tax dollars at work. Okay, Chauncey, are we ready? Let's go to that first break, and we'll be back with Horse Soldiers and Doug Stanton.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Thank you very much. Who was that gentleman that did that? No, I know who that was. But anyway, that was from the Mr. Tom Monahan, who is one of our sponsors here at WDEO. In fact, the Ave Maria Network is his baby. So I just wanted to mention that Mr. Monahan was the Domino's Pizza founder. Yes. Also, one of our sponsors is U.S. Wings. U.S. Wings. Everything you want in apparel and little tchotchkes for your military person. I know we got Christmas time coming up. Hey, what better way to shop for that military special person than to go to info at uswings.com. info@uswings.com. Let me just read a couple things off here. U.S. Navy pea coats, military field jackets, motorcycle jackets, yeah, military insignia jackets, fleece outerwear, cloth jackets, sweaters, oh, and B-3 bomber jacket. Where are you going to get that? Where are you going to get a B-2 and a B-3 bomber jacket? Hmm? I also saw there, Top Flight. There you go. The Top Flight pilots, they're wearing leather jackets. Well, you can get one just like it. And is it just like it? It's not a knockoff, all right? It is the real deal because U.S. Wings gets the patterns directly from the military. So don't delay. You've got something to do for Christmas. You want to check out info@uswings.com.
Back on Veterans Radio, and coming right out right now is going to be our first segment. We're going to be talking with Doug Stanton. I just want to read something from one of his articles in the Washington Post back in December. It says, in mid-October, early November 2001, about 36 Army Special Forces soldiers landed in northern Afghanistan, and with the help of a handful of CIA officers, quickly routed a Taliban army whose estimated size ranged from 25 to 50,000 fighters. Allied with the Afghan fighters, this incredibly small number of first-in soldiers achieved in about 8 weeks what the Pentagon had thought would take 2 years. For the first time in U.S. history, Army Special Forces were deployed as the lead element in a war. I want to welcome to Veterans Radio Doug Stanton, the author of Horse Soldiers. Welcome, Doug.
Good morning, Dale. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For all of us, our listeners out there, the name of the book is Horse Soldiers. Tell me where that came from.
It came from the fact that these first 12 U.S. Special Forces soldiers from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, back in October of 2001, land in the dark in Afghanistan without any real clear sense that they'd ever get home again. And allying with the Afghan militias that are there essentially along tribal lines, have to ride horses against the Taliban in this very old-fashioned 19th century form of warfare, which would make the story fascinating to me is it's coupled with very high-tech 21st century kinds of equipment, essentially lasers. So if listeners want to just imagine a moment, say Colorado or Nebraska, but with huge mountains in the distance, really no people out in this landscape except Taliban in black pickup trucks and then militias and rags on horseback and with some motorized vehicles kind of charging each other across these vast distances, literally like in the Civil War, so that the bombs would drop after the Afghans, or just before the Afghans had kind of charged the Taliban line. So it's as one of the guys in the book said to me, it was like the Jetsons meets the Flintstones.
Well, I'll tell you, and your descriptions of what was going on over there and the terrain just had me, transfixed. As a former helicopter pilot, flying, I never flew over 20,000-foot mountains, but I can remember getting lost in a thunderstorm cloud once and never being so petrified in my whole life. And
yeah,
you were talking about these Chinook pilots that, you know, had the night vision goggles and all this other equipment, and they're trying to get these Chinooks up over these 20,000-foot mountains, and then they got to drop down, you know, to, you know, 1,000 feet to let these guys off in the middle of the night. I'm stuttering now only because I could feel, you know, the anxiety that these guys must have had. They must have had to pry their fingers off the cyclic controls.
Yeah, you know, I like helicopter pilots. I think you guys are some of the unsung heroes of all of these missions because drop people off and then you go away, and we follow the guys in the ground. But these Chinook missions had never really, well, they hadn't, they may have been attempted before, but these guys from the 160th SOAR, and if people know the great story of Black Hawk Down,
mm-hmm.
the Special Operations Aviation Unit that delivered these special, these SF guys in October. And So they're going, and as you know, in a helicopter, you just can't pour on the power at a certain altitude and just gain more height because you're running out of pitch in the blades and the air is getting too thin. So they're actually stair-stepping through the mountains using a topo map.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the, I remember one of the guys sitting in the middle seat would say, well, I think if we go another meters, we turn left, we can gradually gain some altitude. If we keep going straight, we're going to hit this cliff and have to rise, say, 300 feet all at once. So it's like walking up a mountain sideways as opposed to kind of hitting it straight on.
It's like trying to drive up a mountain with all the switchbacks.
Right.
Yeah, you're trying to catch the updrafts if you can somewhere, and hopefully that will help you. But, you know, I don't want to...
The doors are open. Well, it's funny because I thought at one point... And this book is filled with a lot of real drama and a lot of moments of humanity in it. But at one point I thought, well, okay, they get in a helicopter, they fly from Uzbekistan into central Afghanistan. I could probably do that in a page. But I spent a week with these guys, interviewed over 100 people for the book, and I was down at Fort Campbell. And I realized they really deserved their own long section of chapter in the book because it was such a heroic feat. I mean, even getting into Afghanistan back then was a challenge. I mean, let alone the question of surviving once you landed.
Oh, sure. If people that are looking on our website right now, if you're watching the webcast, they're going from Uzbekistan to Mazar-e-Sharif, correct?
Flying over Mazar and headed to a little village along a river called Dehi.
Right.
Which... It's so fascinating because what happened back in 2001, what we're dealing squarely with today in 2010, and I wrote a new chapter for the paperback, which is out now, but because I thought when I was working on this book, we weren't talking about Afghanistan even a year ago, really, in the news a lot.
Right.
The Americans and the Afghans were the underdogs in this fight, and you talked about ingenuity in your intro. The Taliban owned the country, and they had armor, they had anti-aircraft guns, which they didn't fire up in the air. They fired as direct fire across the terrain at objects.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would dig in these lines, much like in the Civil War, and the Afghan Northern Alliance, which is the nominal U.S. allies, would charge them on their horses, and they would overwhelm or swarm the mechanized line, and then they would break and retreat and run away, literally.
Oh.
And so when we show up in after 9/11, this has been going on among the Afghans for several years. And the Afghans, and even today, we can talk about what's going on there today in a moment, but we're very happy to see the United States arrive because at this point, using lasers and so on, once the Afghans had swarmed the Taliban line and retreated, they always took the hill, but then they were pushed back off when the armor regrouped and came back.
Mm-hmm.
Now the laser-guided bombs come in, and they are targeted, and those trucks and those tanks are blown up.
You mentioned...
They can't re-attack.
Yes. You mentioned at the beginning of your book, and we're talking with Doug Stanton, the author of Horse Soldiers, here on Veterans Radio. I wanted to just go back real quickly to taking those guys into Afghanistan, is that inside those helicopters, there's no heat. And also, they're up at 20,000 feet, and they didn't have oxygen masks, did they?
Well, they did, but this happened... What this is really a story about is doing a whole lot with very little. So, to get this, you know, there is no plan A in the Pentagon to go into Afghanistan, so these guys are it. The 160th is called. They literally tear down the Chinook helicopters bolt by bolt. They load them into these huge transport planes. They take them over there. They put them back together, and they start flying these missions nonstop all around the country. They discover at these altitudes that the oxygen systems on these have not really been maintained because they've never been tested like this. So at one point, each one of these rides over these ridges becomes like a mini death for these guys because only the pilot has real oxygen left and the rest of the guys either pass out or get very woozy from hypoxia. And that even going on through that, I thought was amazing with these pilots. You know, to know that you're going to take off and you wake up with a terrible headache and it's basically like being knocked out. And but they kept on going and they dropped them off and then they would go back to their base called K2 in Uzbekistan.
Okay, tell me a little bit about one of the Afghan tribal leaders was kind of given the order of to lay out a landing strip of 14 light bulbs, but he had no electricity.
So when we're going about our business back in September and October 2001, we're not really aware that there are different tribal relations in Afghanistan, and they're all basically been at war with each other since the Soviets left. The Hazaras are fighting the Tajiks and the Pashtuns, which now we know about because of the Taliban. So Mahakek gets the call, however, that some CIA officers will be landing. This is to kind of prep the idea that more of these special forces guys might be welcome. In other words, if they land, the question to Mahakek is, if these guys land, are you going to kill them or capture them?
Right.
He agrees, we've been fighting all of this. However, we've been fighting each other. Our larger enemies, the Taliban, so let them land. So to make sure that it's clear and safe, however, as you know, as a helicopter pilot, when you go over the LZ, you're looking at there might be some kind of sign, either a strobe or, in this case, it was 14 light bulbs, not 12, and not 13 and not 15. And if they saw 14, they knew it was safe to land. So he has to jerry-rig some form of power off of a generator and a battery. And I'm to this day, I'm not quite sure how he was able to create that.
I just envisioned that, coming down from 25,000 feet, probably through the clouds and everything, and you see no light anywhere, and then suddenly you see these 14, 20-watt light bulbs,
mm-hmm.
Lying in the middle of the desert somewhere, and you land, and you're surrounded by all these guys that all don't look real safe.
No, and they're standing on the edge of a dirt pad, which may be, between 60 feet and 50 meters across, and come out with wearing blankets and turbans and guns slung under the garments. And speaking a language that a lot... the thing about special forces is they do have language training, and so they came in, they're very aware of what to do and not to do, kind of to gain the friendship of these locals. But they did not speak Dari, which is the Afghan...
particular dialect. Can we back up just a minute, Doug, and can you tell us a little bit about the difference between the special forces and the regular army? Because there's a major difference there.
There is. I think for us, the way to, just for a moment to go back to World War II and think of the OSS officers and of many different nationalities dropped behind enemy lines and working in an underground resistance. So, for instance, the American OSS goes into France. They live secretly behind enemy lines. They likely speak French. And they understand the culture, and they work within that culture to get all the locals, who may not be fighters, but all pointed in one direction, and to overthrow the occupying force. In that case, it was the Nazis, for instance. But in this case, you want to think of these guys as providing the same kind of... facing the same challenge. They go in and instead of the Nazis, they're going after the Taliban, and they're working with the locals who aren't happy about their presence in their country. And later, the OSS is disbanded, and the CIA is born out of some form of that, and then Special Forces comes in the 50s as well, and they're part of the U.S. Army, and they're generally older, and they generally love the idea that they're out there by themselves thinking and making decisions at the ground level, which
They haven't changed in 40 years. We worked a lot with those guys in Vietnam. We're talking with Doug Stanton here, the author of Horse Soldiers, which is a great book about the initial incursion of American forces into Afghanistan. And again, reading the book that we had already started bombing, but because we didn't have anybody on the ground, we weren't being very effective. Is that correct?
Right. October 7th of 2001. That bombing started, but at 30 to 40,000 feet, even less, and so it has all these adverse effects that locals don't like it when the bombs start landing around them, and maybe they're on your side. So you really do need people on the ground, and in Afghanistan, you need people back then who can, let's say you're from one tribe and I'm from another. I might go to the American and say, I might point you out as an enemy to him. And then if that American soldier is not smart enough to deconflict that situation and realize it's really a blood feud that they're trying to settle, you're not actually a Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of kind of cultural and social and historical stuff these guys had to be aware of they acted very smartly on the ground, and they were aided by the fact that they were fighting really in this moonscape. This was not urban warfare, and they were not actually targeting populated centers, because this area had been decimated by civil war and fighting with the Taliban over the previous years. So if you were on a truck, the instructions ahead, if you saw a pickup truck, it had to be a Taliban. Mm-hmm. And if you're on a horse, you're generally an American, or you're part of the Northern Alliance.
Well, let's get into that for the story. They've landed. They've made their connections with their contacts in Afghanistan. And one of the first things they have to do is get on a horse and go about 60 miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which sounds kind of easy to us. I mean, well, not easy, but...
Not for those of us who can't
ride. Sounds
doable.
But it's not a dude ranch. And
yeah, describe their saddle.
So, yeah, their saddle is probably like sitting in a laundry basket strapped to top of a rolling, jarring, you know, animal that is climbing a switchback, you know, that's 3 feet wide, up and up a mountain, and down the mountain, and across, and then up another mountain, and going on for days. And in the distance, you see antennas of Taliban bunkers, because they've kind of they're positioned in the area. And so, what they're doing is probing and moving ahead, and they would set up on positions to get off the horses. And with binoculars and rangefinders and radios, begin to target these Taliban bunkers, and that's what made this so successful. I mean, literally in about 2 weeks, they did what the Pentagon thought would take about 2 years. So it's done on the back of the horse, from the back of the horse. This, and then they would set up for these set piece battles where the Northern Alliance would charge. They'd set up these targets, and then they'd charge the line. And then they'd coordinate that with these airstrikes. It was, at one point, there was a problem where the horsemen sent off too soon.
Oh.
And the Americans thought, oh no, they're going to arrive at the Taliban line just at the time that the bombs hit. And because, you remember, however sophisticated this is, it's really about 1,000 guys on horses lined up behind ridge lines as screens. And then when the call comes over, literally the Motorola walkie-talkie, go, they start rising up and down over this rolling hill. So the message goes out too soon, and the Americans look on in horror, and the bombs just land, just as the horses are about 100 meters away. I mean,
wow.
Guys get knocked off because of the shockwave. Miraculously, nobody died, but the horses are leaping through the smoke. And the dust that's falling over the line, I thought it was incredible. And that's how they began to march north towards Mazar-e Sharif, which was the strategic city.
Right, and the whole idea for our listeners' audience, the picture that comes to my mind is a big, you know, old-fashioned cavalry charge. And, you know, you're going up against, you're on horses, but you're going up against tanks and automatic weapons and so on and so forth that the Taliban had. And now, of course, now you're only, you know, you're 10 seconds ahead or behind, hopefully, of bombs hitting that area. It must take incredible courage, not only for the Americans, but, of course, those Afghan fighters.
Yeah, it did. I mean, these are young men and middle-aged men who have been at war since 1979, many of them. So, and I also feel that they sensed that history in some ways was with them now. I mean, at least they had a fighting chance with however dicey the bombs falling made it for them as they charged, that it was the one thing that could change the equation for them, because they'd literally been locked in a stalemate. The United States lands in this village at Dehi, 60 miles south of Mazar-e Sharif, because it's about as far as the Taliban trucks and armor could probe and face off with the Alliance, because after that the terrain got too rocky. So they had scrambled up into the ridges and the rocks on their horses, hiding out from the Taliban, who were kind of down below and owned the rest of the valley. So this changed the picture for the Alliance.
We're talking with Doug Stanton, author of Horse Soldiers. If you'd like to give us a call and ask a question, that number is 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. And I think we've got a picture in there, if you could pull that up, of those guys actually charging across the desert, you know, when you get an opportunity to put that up. I wanted to ask you about these special forces, or let's talk a little bit about the policy of when these special forces went in. They didn't go in wearing uniforms and, you know, carrying American flags, did they?
Well, they wore uniforms, but, I mean, as a rule, the special forces had never cooperated with a book of this nature, and I had told them that I wanted to talk about who they were as people, that I wanted to, and I also went to Afghanistan and interviewed the Afghans on the other side of the fight and walked all the battlefield. So they were a little leery at first, but once it was clear that this was really a story about the dramatic challenges of this, and it wasn't about the technical aspects of it so much, I was fine. But the point is, what you're saying is that they go in secretly, and they wear local garb. They would wear scarves. Anything. They didn't go native by any means, but they let their hair grow out, and they do grow beards, because the beard in Afghan culture is a sign of respect and so on. So their job is to really gain rapport with the locals. And it's through that, by working within the community, that they create what they think is social change. In other words, I'm not going to hammer at this problem from the outside only with bullets, that if we really want people to change a mindset, we've got to figure out what it is they want at the grassroots level and decide whether or not we can give it to them.
That's what an interesting idea, right?
Yeah.
Wonder why they got away from that. We'll talk about that in the next portion. We got about a minute and a half till we take a break at the bottom of the hour. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the? I know, let's talk about some of the people that are in the book that you really admired.
Well, the two young captains, Dean and Mitch, had worked in special forces. They're incredibly intelligent. They knew as much about Afghanistan as a college professor when they went in. They had done all this reading, and their job really is to get close to the Afghan leaders and just do what I just said. You know, what do you need? What do you want? Do those goals align with the United States? And what do the people want? And so they're really living on the edge, and that's what was interesting to me. Is they're making a lot of decisions. They're being trained to kind of work in a very fluid environment where no one is there to tell them what to do. And yet, so they've got to hold a couple of different options and outcomes in their mind at once. The training they go through is essentially gets them used to a sense of failure so that they can recover very quickly from it. I think it's a template and a model, and we're seeing some of these ideas embedded in the current insurgency strategy today in Afghanistan, believe it or not, which we could talk about after the break. But
we've got to take a break right now. Doug, we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
This is a pre-recorded program that was recorded on July 2nd, 2010, Horse Soldiers with Doug Stanton and Dale Throneberry.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Captain George McMurtry, wounded on two separate occasions, continued to lead his battalion in combat in World War I. Details after this. McMurtry was commander of a battalion which was cut off and surrounded by the enemy. And although wounded in the knee by shrapnel and suffering great pain, he continued throughout the entire period to encourage his officers and men with an optimism that contributed largely toward preventing panic and disorder among the troops who were without food and cut off from communications with our lines. During a heavy barrage, he personally directed and supervised the moving of the wounded to a shelter before himself seeking shelter. 2 days later, he was again wounded, this time in the shoulder by a German grenade, but continued to personally organize and direct the defense against the German attack on the position until the attack was defeated. He continued to direct and command his troops, refusing relief, and personally led his men out of the position after assistance arrived before permitting himself to be taken to the hospital. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Now back to Veterans Radio's pre-recorded program, recorded on July 2nd, 2010.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with Doug Stanton, the author of Horse Soldiers, about an extraordinary story of a band of U.S. soldiers that rode to victory in Afghanistan. And just before the break, we were talking about a couple of the leaders. And, Doug, I'm going to ask you to continue on with that, about the just the type of men that were there.
They're members of the U.S. Army who like to get away from the flagpole, put it that way. They speak several languages. They're often one of the ranking kind of U.S. diplomats on the ground, so to speak. And they live among the locals, and they hope that the locals don't betray them. So they're really fighting behind enemy lines, and they tend to be very independent, smart, funny. A fellow named Sam Diller lived with two other guys on his team, because it was a 12-man team split down to four different cells of three, moving out over an area of about 60 square miles across and then pushing north. And Sam is up on one meal a day with no way to really resupply himself because they're moving so fast. He was like a ghost in the mountains. There were people in Mazar-e Sharif to the north who heard the sound of these bombs at night, and they were the bombs of Sam and his team targeting the Taliban. And Taliban men would leave the village of Mazar-e Sharif or the city and never come back. And they began to think that somehow in the valley this monster had come to life. It was actually Sam Diller moving at lightning speed across these ridgetops through the fog on horseback with himself and, say, you know, between 24 and 50 Afghan fighters just moving and bombing, shooting, avoiding ambushes. And then all these different cells on November 10th, 2001, reconnect and gather at the gates of Mazar-e Sharif, and they've captured their city, and they ride through it, and the Afghans hear the Americans are coming with their own fellow countrymen, and they line the streets. And Colonel Major Mark Mitchell, now Colonel Mark Mitchell, is he's in a daze. They have pushed so fast and so far, and they look up, and there are hundreds of Afghans lining the street clapping. And he thinks for a moment that this must have been how his own grandfather felt back in World War II, because the locals are truly happy to see these guys, because they've been living under draconian kind of conditions. Not that suddenly life just got all really good for everybody. The barbers are moving their chairs out into the streets, literally. Young teenage guys are walking around with boomboxes playing music. Little kids are flying kites. All these things have been forbidden. Mm-hmm. The 4 or 5 years of Taliban rule in Mazar. I mean, guys are lining up on the sidewalk to get their beards cut off. It's in some ways, Mitchell thought it was comical and humorous and such a contrast to the kind of austere life they had all lived since being dropped off in that helicopter, you know, weeks before, and then getting on those horses.
I think it's the book gets fairly graphic here, folks. So you have to go and you're going to have to go and buy the book Horse Soldiers, because he talks about what life was like before the Americans arrived and before the Northern Alliance were able to take back some of these cities. And it's awful. I mean, it's the tortures and what they did to women, what they did to boys and men, and so forth. I want to get into, because we've got about 9 minutes left, sounds like a lot, but it goes really quickly. I want to talk about not the castle, but the fortress with the CIA, and I don't have his name in front of me, the young boy who was an American member of the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. Right, John Walker Lind.
Right.
From Bryn, California. And he had set off to study Arabic in Yemen and so on with the blessing of his parents. And November 25th, 2001, he finds himself through a series of extremely ill-informed decisions, I think also just bad luck, and I think also finally at some point he found himself in the middle of in the middle of the world of the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda, at which point for him to have kind of said to those guys, okay, I came over here. He claims that, and we'll never know, but that once he had moved into Yemen and he went to this language school and he, et cetera, it was entering another world. I mean, he's no longer part of the kind of U.S. news stream that we think of. When he left, the U.S. was not at war in Afghanistan. So he's now essentially in the middle of a combatant situation. November 25th, 2001, he is coming face to face with a CIA officer named Mike Spann,
right,
who is one of these initial guys who'd gone in on these helicopters and worked with the special forces because they had some connectivity with these different alliance leaders previous to 9/11. Spann, according to, for instance, one of the guys, his partner, who did survive this attack, they all seem to think that this fellow that he was staring at, sitting on a carpet in a mud fortress that looked like something out of Arabian Nights, where they'd all been captured after the entrance into Mazar-e Sharif, couldn't quite figure out if he was Canadian or there's something strange about this guy. Lind, in later court testimony, said that he was unclear who Spann was. And because Spann's partner did speak Uzbek and et cetera, he claims that it was unclear to him if he would be surrendering to an American at this point or to say an Uzbek, and therefore putting himself in even deeper harm's way. So at any rate, a fight breaks out in this fortress, and these prisoners, of which Lind is a member or part of their population, who've surrendered in a Trojan horse move,
right,
the last third of the book, several days earlier, riot, and they take over the fort, and suddenly this horse run, which had gone, was incredibly challenging and dramatic, but now they're fighting a battle, as one of them said to me, that was like the Alamo anyway, in some ways, except the bad guys are trying to break out instead of breaking in. And everyone of the U.S. contingent had moved off to another part of the country, leaving only about 8 to 12 Americans to try to contain 600-plus Taliban or Al-Qaeda fighters who were determined to break out of this fortress in a way that would allow them then to take back the city, which was undermanned now because the force had moved off to another part of the country. So this battle raged for a good part of a week, and it was finally put down. Unfortunately and tragically, in the middle of this, Mike Spann, who had come face-to-face with Lind, is the first American to be killed in post-9/11 conflict. His body remains in the fort until the end of this battle, when it can be removed and flown back on one of these Chinook helicopters. John Walker Lind is discovered, and he becomes worldwide news, if listeners remember back to footage of him on CNN being discovered. Shocking everybody. How in the world, first of all, 9/11 is a shock.
Well, we're going to have to get off the air right now. So this is Bob Gould, Veterans Radio. Come on back next year. Until then, you are dismissed. Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.